Ah, good evening, and welcome to our regular Thursday stream. I don't know, I
Evening.
calling it Starman on the Boomer at the moment. I it seems to make the titles a bit long, and you guys know what the show is anyway. So I've stopped putting out the title just because it clogs it up, and we have different theme streams anyway. So it's me and Trigger still here. It's still Starman on the Boomer, but I'm making the titles a bit shorter.
He says with the breadline security state. But
The
yes.
Breadline Security State is a relatively concise stream name, Trigger.
It
It's not that bad.
yes, I suppose.
It's it it desc I think it describes it well. Also, I d did deliberately make that thumbnail as like David Dees as humanly possible.
Oh, rest in peace, David Dees.
Do you stole my shoes? We can probably talk about it later on, but I did see something from Ben Garrison today, which is dangerously close to being like identical to the edits that Paul used to make of him once upon a time. He may have gone.
The lamppost one. Yes.
Yeah, it's,
That
he's
was
like got.
that was full Fed post tier.
He's got like a Fauci thing talking about going from a goalpost to moving to lampposts, but. Surprising for Mr. L Label Everything Garrison. He's gone from Boomer Garrison to Zyklon Ben, which is quite funny.
I am here as well, by the way.
I was gonna say
Indeed.
I was about to introduce you, Evelyn. Evelyn is also here. No, it's our regular guest and general behind the scenes ferret who makes us look smart. Evelyn is here.
Yes.
Say hello.
Hamlo.
There we go. We're going to be talking about a few things today. It will come into a cohesive whole, we promise. But I think the main jumping off point really is the hilarious fact that I guess what would be what people describe as InfoWars for tankies, which just makes it sound kind of based. An outlet called the Gray Zone, which, if you know your like weird mid-2000s journalism lore, is run by Max Blumenthal of all people, the son of Sidney Blumenthal, who was part of the Clinton administration as an advisor, which is a bit of a I don't know whether to trust it or not sometimes, but there we go. There's an article by the Gray Zone.
I was gonna say he's gonna know where the skeletons are buried, so to speak, but whether or not he's gonna point us in the right direction is another question.
I'm.
Look, the man's just wanting to derail leftist activists. He's not letting it get shot to shoot himself in the chest twice.
I would very much consider him part of like the anti-Israel left and kind of the old like anti-security state left, kind of more of the in the vein of, oh, what's the guy called who did the Prism Leaks and all that? My brain's gone dead. He's Green something or other. My brain's gone dead. God damn it.
Are you talking about Glenn Greenwald?
Yeah, Glenn Greenwald. That's it.
Oh,
Kind
yeah.
of, like if Glenn Greenwald worked for Gawker. It's kind
Dear
of a
God,
weird
that's
way
not
to put
I
it, but.
think Greenwald did work for like an ex-Gawker outlet at one point.
Oh dear. Oh dear. Everyone. Yeah.
Good God.
I don't know. I don't know which one it was, but that would be depressing if he ever did. Yes, it's. The article is leaked files expose serious PSYOPs veteran astroturfing bread tube star to counter restriction critics. This. Again, it's kind of funny because this is one more impactful, better researched, and also in the content a lot more base than a lot of what like Breitbart or even like people like Lotus Eaters would put out. It's kind of funny coming from someone like Blumenthal and the Gray Zone, and essentially the what is considered the hardcore left by some people. Yeah, Greenwald is a little bit of a mess, but he's it's kind of that.
He Joe he gives toxic Mises, so he can't be that bad.
No. I think give them mean personally because he is personally a little bit of a mess, but I don't know who isn't. It's the article itself is a little bit long-winded with some of its assertions.
Yeah, I think a lot of it is, some of it is cope or not trying to admit that the entirety of leftist activism is a state-op. I mean, he's trying to be like, this bit is, but also like the fact that it's like all these institutes were looking towards, you know, like as we get into in the article, you know, it's about challenging disinformation and critiquing dangerous super spreaders and this kind of nonsense, and he doesn't at any point want to connect that to, like, you know, why do the elites feel the need to do this in terms of this policy? You know, why do they feel they need to convince us? That's the questions he's not really willing to ask. But I think the stuff that is in here, there is enough meat and bones to really sort of redefine the way that the landscape has been looked at, and the way that I think we have been looking at it for a while, that a lot of people have been reluctant to, is to understand that modern leftist activism isn't all pretenses, just a facet of modern state agitation.
Yeah. Before we go any further, I was just going to quickly do the shilling, the normal shilling, which is you can actually support us on the channel. We do have monetization. If you want to send a super chat, please do. But our preferred method is through Streamlabs. I put the Streamlabs link in the chat. That we get the highest cut that way. You can also join the channel if you want to support us monthly. It does help out, and it does help us occasionally upgrade equipment and things like that, because or just have some beer money. But yes, this is our
only research materials for that money. No beer.
I'm gonna say we have bought I've bought a lot of books over the past couple of weeks. So we'll be doing a lot of reading and a lot of research. So that's where these donations will be going. Thank you for correcting me there, Evan. Sorry, you were saying there, Craig. I just wanted to get the YouTube-y stuff out of the way.
I was going to say, as you know, when journalists start going into the why and its supposition, sometimes they can discredit themselves in the process. So the fact that they haven't gone into the why and they've just said the what is in this article, perhaps a little more credibility there, because it's very easy for someone who's far left or far right or radical centrist or whatever to go, and they're doing this because this, that, and the other, and X, Y, and Z.
Are also
you can discredit yourself in the process. Yeah.
It's lying by omission still, though. It is ultimately, you know, it is a bit kind of like a Sargon move of being like, well, you know, this aspect of the right is such and such, but these positions are still valid.
Well, fair.
It's an interesting... the interesting meat of it is that there was a leaked document. For those of you who don't know, Philosophy Tube is some cringe video essayist who gets pushed by the mainstream platforms like YouTube. Like they've been pushed in the media, they've been talked about on the BBC for some reason, because they decided that their best career move was to have some very obviously not genuine transition going on.
I think you mentioned before that there was some part in the article that brought that up before, but I couldn't seem to find it when I looked earlier, so I don't know if that's been scrubbed or something.
It might have been scrubbed because there were some bits. People, and the reaction on Twitter was like, wow, I can't believe how transphobic this is. Because there was some like balls out bits, like using their previous name and all that. Which is kind of funny.
I don't know if we want to look past the fact that Abigail Thorne is a potent hon, the sort of key institutions sort of involved in this whole process, there is I believe it's the Royal Institution that was handling the... I think they were the people who originally reached out, but they are also being... they're also being enlisted by something called Valent Projects. Now, Valent Projects, when you look at it on the face of it, is just like some generic PR website, and it's got some dude who used to be a Middle East correspondent for the BBC, blah, blah, blah. But what it is it's like the OSS in America in the 20s and 30s. It's Edward Bernays and his mates, you know, engaging in, you know, public relations proper, because let's not forget where that term comes from. And it is outwardly put forward as a public relations, you know, network that has been used in UK Foreign Office behaviours since at least the 90s in some way, shape, or form.
Yes, it has, and there's a great like through line here of they do connect the dots quite well of the fact that these are the very same people who had been putting out a lot of the material in Syria and about Syria.
Hmm.
And that they were the, it's basically a version of the war on terror tactics coming home. It's the information war, quite literally info war.
It's a war for your mind.
Well, it's the information war from the, you know, the Arab Spring onwards, all that complete gaslight about democratizing the Middle East, like coming home to roost, essentially. What they talk about here is the real meat of the article is that, yeah, Valiant has also been sponsored by the U.S. Agency for International Development, a U.S. intelligence cutout project that investigates disinformation. Basically, USAID, as its acronym is a front for the CIA.
Mm.
It just is that. And the Royal Institution, as hilariously sponsored by the COVID bill, the endowment for the arts equivalent here.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, before we get to that, I think it might be worth discussing the model that they've used for this, which is one that has been used a lot. And, you know, this is one specifically abrasive case of this.
Yes.
Where, you know, it's, according to internal documents, Valiant plans to design a mass appeal social media campaign fronted and owned by prominent social media figure Abigail Thorne, the founder of Philosophy Tube. Valiant's research on British citizens who reject official policy on COVID-19 will be used to devise a campaign that utilises YouTuber Abigail Thorne's existing platform to achieve a measurable cognitive shift in the audience. So what it's, you know, essentially, they are creating this person as a public figure by doing the whole, like, oh, they're trans now thing all over media.
Yeah.
And so they have influence, quote-unquote, in a way that they didn't have before. And then they are used to just, you know, convince normies and Zoomers and gay millennials that involve themselves in a really low-brow version of, like, socialist political discourse on the internet into becoming COVID stooges. And that this doesn't just happen to these few, you know, to this one YouTuber or anything, but I think me and you have discussed a bit more, is that this was a model that was then used across the entire sort of influencer network. I mean, I don't know how many people do or don't use Instagram, but if you're someone that uses it, your feeds for the last 12 months will have been dominated by paid for, sponsored posts aimed directly at young people that makes things like getting your jab and using the Vax ID pass to get into new clubs and new trendy music and blah blah blah, and they're selling it all, and the government is throwing billions, countless billions, to all these different media outlets as a sort of intermediary so that essentially they can funnel as much propaganda into your phone as possible.
Well, it's something we've talked about it before, Trig. It's something we've long suspected, that a lot of this quote unquote bread tube stuff is just a front. I've had arguments with multiple people telling them not to engage with this stuff and not to become the reply guy, because it is quite literally an op. And now we have evidence of it. We have direct evidence that these people are just like the talking heads being puppeted quite literally by the intelligence services. If you look at it here, it says phase two. The direct sneaks for phase two will be determined by the findings derived from research carried out in phase one. However, a number of project characteristics and objectives, blah blah blah, due to the nature of mass appeal social media campaign fronted and owned by, prominent social media figure Abigail Thorne. It is 100% astroturfed. This is being planned by a group that has been given government funding, has worked in Syria on these counter narratives, in quotes, by enabling these, you know, social media influencers, and his even like accepting, like I said, ironically, money that is meant to be COVID relief, whilst also putting out like pro lockdown propaganda.
Well, that's because that literally is the culture. I mean, in a certain sense, they're not lying and saying that this money has been adequately placed. It is. It's been placed in the hands of a culture that we don't like. But it's. I think maybe we could possibly sort of brush over some of the specifics and sort of just have the general understanding before we go into some of the latter portions of the article that become more relevant. That the bread tube, both in Britain, and as we will probably find out in a short amount of time in America, is probably completely funded and set up by the CIA.
Yes.
I mean, I'm just waiting for the documents to come out for that one. So it becomes no wonder why, you know, everyone sits there talking about Vouch and Abigail Thorne, all these different people, and that they're hypocrites. It's once again a case of the fact that these people aren't hypocrites. They are just the bullhorn for the imperial regime. And they just don't care.
I was just about to mention Vouch, because people like that, they appeared out of nowhere with a large following. They got all of the support they required from YouTube and via social media. And, you know, having put in the graft for a couple of years and gotten to, you know, you get to 1,000, maybe 2,000 subscribers, viewers. No, these people put in the graft for a couple of years and they've got 500,000 viewers. No, they're not saying that anything that's that particularly different, but they've got the backing behind it, and that's considering Alphabet and various other organizations associated with Alphabet seem to work hand in hand with Alphabet agencies anyway.
I've just noticed something I missed when reading this article before. What? He names Vouch. Other popular breadtube figures include Vouch, a former gamer from Beverly Hills, California, named Ian Kuczynski.
Mm-hmm. Oh no.
Known for his superficial understanding of Marxism, and then it's his comment about imprisoned journalist Julian Assange. I want Assange to die in a CIA black site just because it would trigger all the worst people on Twitter. Now, if that's not projection by a man who's been taken to a CIA black site and threatened, then I don't know what is.
Well, there's the whole thing that the he quotes what's he called? He quotes someone called Caleb Mappin, who is like a hardcore socialist, to be honest. Mm. But he's basically talking about he says that BreadTube speaks in, you know, kind of at the surface level of left-wing ideas. In reality, they are likely serving a section of the American elite and the intelligence agencies. Like, it's like the reverse of Le Horseshoe theory. It's people on the periphery of politics who are genuinely not subsumed in the establishment have noticed that none of this makes sense. That these people, like it says here, these people, they popped out of nowhere with fully formed audiences, and they became the quote-unquote face of the left. And people fucking fell for it. And I felt like a crazy person. Because I got in trouble for it, but I showed you the screenshots of me talking to people, and then being like, oh no, these people definitely have influence on policy. And I'm like, you fucking, you absolute like, drooling retard, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you?
That's the exact point of it, though, is they instigate the creation of these people and their supposed ideas so that they can play themselves as the moderates just behind the radical left asking for whatever they want.
These people don't have influence on policy. What is happening is policy is using them to make sure that they have a groundswell of support, or at least the appearance of it. And as I said, they appeared out of nowhere. 10-15 years ago, the left were as anti-establishment as I was. I had actually found out whilst I was very, very...
I'm not buying that for a second.
Okay, certainly a lot of my friends who were very left-wing and who were sort of, you know, a bit tanky or not tanky, but certainly left wing. We used to have some cracking arguments, but both of us could agree that the main problem was the government large government being the big problem. These days, left wing, certainly social media left wing, is very definitely, you know, big daddy state. Please give me more. That's changed recently. That is new. And by new, I mean in the last 15 years. That's, you know, maybe
I'm not entirely sure about that, I'm afraid. I think during the time of, just from what I've read alone in, say, some of Peter Hitchens' work from the 90s, it does not sound like the radical left was framed against Blair. They were only framed against Blair because they were very surface-level involved people who didn't see the man as the Trotskyist that he actually was.
Oh no, a lot of people didn't like Blair because they saw him as a Tory in Labour clothing.
Yeah, but if you're a leftist, he did exactly what you want.
If you're a moderate Tory, he did exactly what you want as
no,
well.
He didn't.
For the first 2 years, the amount of Tory policies that have been tried to be put through, he put through within the first 2 years of his office. Now maybe he changed and stood on his head and, you know, flipped straight after that, which I would agree with. He gained an awful lot of trust with.
As I said, you mean Tory policies like open immigration?
certainly stuff that. Oh God, what's his freaking name? I always forget his name. Grey, bland dude, whose name is just disappears from my head. But the previous Tory Prime Minister who had no popular support.
You mean John Major?
John Major, thank you. God, every time I forget that guy's name, he is so forgettable. There was an awful lot of his stuff was going through under Blair within the first 2 years. Blair turned around and changed very rapidly afterwards. After, was it 98, 99?
I don't know. We shouldn't sit and have an artistic debate about it, but I'm not buying that.
Fair enough. No, I didn't like the word.
You mean like appearance level? I know what you mean. Anyway, the article goes on to talk about the fact that there's a lot of conflicts of interest here. You have a lot of people who are associated with, you know, the Royal Institute and with this communications firm that are part of, you know, the task force on global health diplomacy with COVID-19, and the fact that the head of that task force is in fact somebody who basically worked on the gain of function tests for the Pentagon's Defense Threat Reduction Agency, which Fauci ended up overlapping with. It's all these same people. It's the people who are suspected now of essentially creating the coronavirus, or at least were involved in the research that, you know, that led to the very possible lab release, which apparently is now mainstream, which, you know, that's gone back and forth quite often. It's very incestuous as well. They talk about, you know, challenging disinformation, challenging 5G conspiracies and all this. But basically what they are is they are an enforcement of establishment talking points, which is what BreadTube essentially functions as. They have it's very surface level leftist beliefs, but really when you look at what they believe about foreign policy, that's my water bottle falling off. What they believe about foreign policy, what they believe about, especially the coronavirus, is a lockstep with what the establishment wants. So it's very, you know, it's redundant for people to paint them as these hard left individuals when doing their reply guy videos.
Yeah, don't engage with them. Well, if you engage with them, you end up on the list of opposition. They'll engage back, sure, but no. Just ignore them. Pretend they're not there.
A lot of people have commented that their positions don't make any sense. Their positions don't make any sense by design. They're not meant to have a cohesive worldview. They're meant to have enough trappings of like student leftism to pump your head full of essentially what MI5 and the CIA want you to think.
Mm-hmm. No, it's
there's nothing like giving you a variant of anti-establishment that reinforces the establishment's views, goals, and narratives. So it's a clever wee trick, that one.
Yeah.
What were the other parts of the article you wanted to go over then, Evelyn?
I just think there was some of the points at the bottom where he gets into, I believe it's Valent Projects and some of the people who are involved in Valent Projects' previous behaviour in the Middle East.
Yes. At the bottom, he talks about the fact that the guest of honor at their dinner was the Philosophy Tube, and also that the people who ran essentially this NGO what's he called? The Valorant founder, Hamish Falconer, it was embedded into terrorist organizations and ran serious psyops for armed extremists, as it's framed here. I'm not sure if that if they can deliver on that headline, but I'll have a look here.
Oh, as you say, there's even more to him here. Hamish is the son of Charlie Falconer, a longtime friend and former roommate of UK's former Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Oh, dear.
following the 1997 election victory, Falconer Sr. was elevated to the unelected House of Lords and served in a series of high-ranking government posts through his pal's tenure.
So he's the son of a Labour peer who was chummy-chummy with Tony Blair.
Yeah,
that
basically
says it all, really.
Yeah. Labour, that's the party of the people, guys. It's not a... Not at all incestuous and full of spooks these days.
He talks about the fact that it's linked to the Greenberg program, and their profile of Falconer says that he has led the Foreign Office's terrorism response team UK efforts to start a peace process in Afghanistan and served in Pakistan and South Sudan, and served a stint in the National Crime Agency. So again. Security state.
Well, I was going to say even further here. We have a small bit on what's his face, Khan, who's part of that Valorant group, and it's talking about how at one point he was part of the security think tank Chatham House, which, if I'm right in saying, is one of the key think tanks that is actually above the Sage group.
Yes, it is.
Yep.
So, you know, you're talking about the think tanks that aren't even put in the public image, you know, essentially like a step away from something like the Council of Foreign Relations.
They're talking about the intelligence contractor ARC, which is very much a private sector arm of MI6. Khan was heavily involved in ARC's Syrian efforts. Another leaked file outlining some of the company's work inside Syria shows that it oversaw a rebranding of the CIA armed Free Syrian Army to portray it as a moderate secular force unconnected with jihadists.
They tried that several times with all sorts, including was it al-Nusra, which was blatantly ISIS all over again.
Well, I think the FSA was al-Nusra. It was literally just the same people walking about in different T-shirts.
Yeah. There's a bit here that will link into what we're talking about later, which is that, the fact that some of the people who worked on this also ended up joining an organization called Mayday Rescue, which is the parent NGO of the White Helmets, which we will get into in some detail, because this campaign by Philosophy, by BreadTube, to AstroTurf pro-lockdown feelings into people is being run by the same people who ran that specific PSYOP in Syria, which they got caught so hard with the White Helmets. It's quite funny, but it's a great worked example of how you can prove that there is a huge amount of propaganda being pumped into British media via the intelligence services, and nobody really calls it out. And there is just constant attempts to rehabilitate these dead narratives, and that the security framework that is used in the war on terror is exactly the same one that has been used in the lockdown propaganda.
Well, yeah,
it's the same people.
They've even got towards the bottom of the article is a brief reference of the Zinc Network, Zinc Network maintains a clandestine nexus of Russian-speaking social media influencers throughout the former Soviet Union, which they still call it for some reason because they're lefties. That's kind of funny, to promote media integrity, democratic values, and complex social issues. A campaign so intense of its relationship with these individual necessities necessitates a daily management. And it goes on to further mention the fact that this group has played a key role in researching how to best market a test and trace app to UK citizens as part of a broader research project on public understanding of and support for artificial intelligence. It's just that every aspect of the security state, be it data, be it physical force, be it media manipulation, it's all converging into these two processes, which is either creating disorder and then sort of integration at home or doing the exact same abroad.
Well, we do have a donation here 9 minutes ago. Thank you, Omi Kane donated $5 and said, Lex Fridman glows like the Chernobyl elephant's foot, DARPA, World Economic Forum, IEEE, etc. 1500 Rogdon. Thank you for the glow review.
Isn't that the weird objectivist dude, Lex Fridman?
Yes, he's very glow.
I happen to know very little about that man, but that's probably a good thing.
Oh yeah, he's right though. He does glow very bright. He does glow like elephant's foot.
I don't know if maybe we want to sort of continue into the direction we want to go though via some of the sections from Nemesis that I'd grabbed.
Oh yeah, this is a perfect example of some of the political theory we've been using. It's also going to link back into some of the democratization stuff we're going to do in future, and possibly some of the post-democratization stuff when we have finished the research for that. Because yeah, I bought like 50 books and I've got to read them.
You've got to read them.
Yeah.
No, I'll read them and I'll give you the best bits.
Okay. Deal. But this is a section from C.A. Bond's Nemesis. You guys can probably find it online. It's like hens. You can't buy it anymore. I don't know if they're going to be reprinting it or not, because basically C.A. Bond disappeared from the internet. But where would you like to start then? Should we just start with the first image here?
Yeah, I think we can. We can maybe come in with a little bit of context first for those who aren't aware about the sort of the stages of constant collapse that were required to instigate sort of Arab Spring, and how that started off in Egypt and Tunisia, and I am no expert, but as far as I'm aware, up until the middle 2000s, Tunisia and Egypt were actually quite well sort of civilized African and Middle Eastern states. And
Tunisia and Egypt were both very popular tourist destinations.
Mm-hmm. I was about to say the same thing, yeah. So they had to, certainly on the surface, put up a decent front for Western tourists from America, Europe, etc.
Well, it wasn't just
the streets clean. They kept, you know, they had good restaurants. They were.
It wasn't just that. Yeah. It was, you know, much like Libya, and now I think the only one left really is Botswana. It was one of the few states in that region that had actually managed to start the road towards what we think of as possibly modernity off their own back without.
Oh yeah. I mean, Libya, like Syria, was before it all cracked up, before they killed Gaddafi, was, you know, it had got its own oil, it had got a thriving economy, you had you know, people going to university, women going to university even. You had a fairly, what we would call, an almost westernized liberal state in Libya. They didn't like it because Gaddafi had managed to do that, whilst also sticking two fingers up at Britain and America because they were meddling over there because they didn't like the oil, etc. Of course, they killed Gaddafi and they turned into the biggest slave trading nation outside of some other friends of the United States.
The UAE.
yeah, precisely.
Lord, them Arabs coming.
I think the quickest intro to this would be that there was the story of a gentleman essentially self-immolating in the street in Tunisia, and all of a sudden, the next day, there's a revolution. Just like that. And some of the bits that are in the article that we don't quite have pictures for, but there are just these lovely little comments from these, you know, from the General Union of Tunisian Workers president talking in an Al Jazeera article of all things. You know, the protests that erupted in Sidi Bouzid were indeed spontaneous, yet they were marked by a level of organisation and sophistication that appeared grounded in the sheer determination of those who participated in them. And then just below that, we have a little source here about a cable sent days before between the UGTT Secretary General and a US ambassador looking to suggest that the UGTT was a natural ally on our freedom agenda goals. It's just...
Yeah, we don't have those in the snips, unfortunately, I don't think.
No, I was looking for those, no.
Yeah, but, I don't know why we've got the particular snips we do.
Well, no, I wanted to use those ones because they specifically discussed the social media aspect that we're getting to, but it was just, it's nice to have the framing of, you know, all these different people talking about, you know, the American people and government historically were respected internationally for supporting peace, democracy, human rights and freedom. Tunisians today still believe these are shared Tunisian-American values.
Tunisian-American values. Oh, good Lord. Yeah, but a lot of people, I think, have forgotten about like the nonsense that was the Arab Spring, and the fact that basically what happened was the CIA toppled a bunch of governments in the Middle East and created a bunch of failed states, essentially.
Yes.
The climax of which being the totally not invasion of Libya.
But. The shortest version of the story is that this case of self-immolation gets blown up on Tunisian Facebook and is then sort of framed in their news and in their social media by actors funded, if not directly working for the American government, as a cause to go out and engage in rebellion.
Yes.
You know, as the perfect model of the colour revolution as we generally know it.
Which of the snippets do you want to start with, then, of the actual ones we have here?
I mean, I think we could just start directly with the first one that we got up and screamed, you know, that where it suggests that the increased communication is outlined in the following relevant section, in addition to talking to the GOT, which I believe is the... Sorry, I briefly misplaced myself.
The government of Tunisia.
Yeah, I thought it was for a second. I was getting
in addition to
there.
Talking to the government of Tunisia, we need to engage directly with the Tunisian people, especially the youth.
I was going to say, not to interrupt you there, but I like the especially youth. So what they're essentially doing, much like the way they used trendy people like Abigail Thorne to put forward COVID measures, they're now using trendy Tunisian Facebook influencers and as early as 2007 to, you know, build this sort of false revolutionary energy. Sorry.
Yeah, the embassy is already using Facebook as a communication tool. In addition, we have the ambassador's blog, a relatively new undertaking that's attracting attention. Over the past couple of years, the embassy has substantially increased its outreach to Tunisian youth through concerts, film festivals, and other events. Very glow. Our information resource center in America's corner are popular ways for Tunisians to access unfiltered news and information. We could continue and increase such programs. The Tunisian government then seems to have been guilty of doing no more than asserting its authority to determine cultural developments within its territory. The US actors, meanwhile, are clearly acting as predatory and aggressive entities. The clear involvement of UF officials on numerous levels in Tunisian revolution is demonstrated by further WikiLeaks cables. One leak dated January 23rd, 2007 details a roundtable discussion between NEA Deputy Assistant Secretary J. Scott Carpenter and six prominent members of Tunisian civil society to discuss democracy advocacy support. More context is provided in a further cable democratization of the region. Sorry, I can't read that word.
it's an unusual word. You don't run into that
one
very
often. It's a word that you don't see very often. Of the region in which it is recorded that Secretary of State Clinton emphasized the importance of civil society's role in the G8 BMENA forum for the future process. That's the thing we talked about earlier. She highlighted the role youth play in the region, noted the use of technology as an important tool to reaching audiences, and said the USG wants to provide technological support to civil society. Civil society representatives expressed tremendous and heartfelt gratitude to the Secretary for her support for the Forum for the Future. And what happened is what happened in the Arab Spring. Absolute unmitigated chaos and death from which these countries have not recovered.
Well, no, excuse me, you can't call it chaos and death. Dare Clinton brought these people civil society, don't you know?
Oh, you had rioting in the streets, people getting... They cut off the internet in the country completely. You'd got countries nearby, or people from nearby, sort of providing mobile phone links so that people could access the internet via phone numbers, old-style modems, and were being sent information on how to make gas masks out of some charcoal, a muslin bag, and a bottle of Coke. Which is actually a very, very effective way of making a gas mask. There was some wild stuff going off there, all glowy as shit, basically supporting the rioters and the protesters to overthrow the government. It was very, very strange time to watch it. It reminded me very much of what was going off in the Maidan in Ukraine just before the previous sort of Russian little green men incident, shall we say?
Well, I was going to say that's possibly something we can discuss slightly more as well, because that is a clear example of the American government funding literally like Israeli-backed neo-Nazi groups on one side, and then you know like Ukrainian nationalists subverted like backed like communist groups.
It was
all just a horrendous mess.
It glowed so badly, so much isn't true. I think every single Western nation had spooks in the area at the time, all playing their own little games. It was mad. But yes.
What this also doesn't factor in as well, and it probably goes without saying, is that there was a lot of also direct involvement in these areas.
Yeah.
There was a lot of stuff going on in Tunisia, in Egypt, of, you know, these... suspiciously new vehicles showing up, and suspiciously, you know, MRVs and things showing up places, and a private security, especially in Libya. If you look at what happened, you know, with the air cover stuff in Libya, especially because they're much more naked with it there. Private PMCs just popped up all over the place. There was PMC guys all over Libya by the time that, you know, the conflict was supposedly just about over. They managed to be on the ground as it was finishing, which, you know, unless they were taking part, that doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. But the same thing is true here. It's not what you're getting is you're getting this mass incitement and you're getting some involvement from that. But what's happening is the confusion is used for direct action. For the, you know, but by the time the dust has settled, by the time that, you know, the uproar has gone away, you have this illusion of bottom up change. And the Arab Spring was anything but that. There were small teams of US-trained people who went in and murdered people, while you know, while there was essentially a the equivalent of a Middle Eastern BLM riot going on, because a bunch of people had listened to some social media influencers and had decided to go to a protest where agitators were. It's a mix of cultural power, and there is always a core of hard power in this, though. There is always these, you know.
I think it is that hard power that was used prior in things like the Gulf War before, though, that allows this soft power, especially when technology was brought to these people. I mean, I think we could. We could maybe continue on to the other screenshot we've got, because that gives us a lot to discuss around how none of this would be possible without technology. I mean, the next section we've got here, there's a brief bit cut out from that previous quote, but I think we got the main bit in, because the rest of it is basically just someone being like, oh, well, the US government should focus on human rights and democracy more, which is always the tagline. But it... It starts off with, this reference to technology is key to the question of why the Arab Spring occurred when it did. The key to this puzzle lies in the lines of communication open to the orders in question. It's fairly well known that in Tunisia, media has been largely monopolised by the government, as mentioned in previously cited cables. To get around this monopoly, social media was utilised. In particular, Facebook and Twitter provided means for organisation, something we've seen yet again more recently with the US officials requesting that Twitter help Iranian protesters. Another pertinent example of this is the US security establishment's attempt at creating a Cuban social media network, Zunzenio or whatever, to help overthrow the Cuban government. The US fostered, organized, and funded social unrest with the overall aims of removing disfavored regimes by using platforms for organization that the regimes in question could not control. Of course, the elements of the US power structure then worked very diligently to efface their role, and the revolution then became a force of nature, or the will of a collection of self-sovereign individuals compromising the people, as opposed to the predatory actions of a foreign power centering force and changes by means considered illegitimate according to its own rules of engagement. Oh, solid gold stuff there from Mr. Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Bond, very based.
But it's just, you know, like, people make the point about things like Facebook being pure aspects of the security state, and we sit there and laugh. But then you look at this, and it, you know, it's the US government created, it was worthwhile to create a social media network in Cuba just to instigate social upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't consider that this might happen on such a bigger scale in our own nations by any chance.
Well, the large thing is that we have all the, you know, Russia, Russian interference in the election, Russian disinformation, blah, 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 blah. They very much consider information warfare against the US itself as beyond the pale, as an attack, you know, as akin to a physical attack. And yet here they are openly boasting about the fact they are instilling these, you know, quote unquote American values in the Tunisian population to the point where there is a societal upheaval that leads to the degeneration of a nation.
I mean, not that anyone would argue. Values.
Yeah, I don't think that anyone would argue that Tunisia and Egypt are better off than they were before these supposedly spontaneous revolutions, in which these societies are now very confused because there has been changes implemented by a class of people that, you know, the actual Tunisian and Egyptian civil society doesn't recognize.
Mm.
They are, you know, these people came out of nowhere. And
it is the model that Bond, you know, is getting from Juvenel. There are a set of, to what, you know, if you are part of the Tunisian government, American, you know, embassy people and foreign office people and Secretary Clinton and all these people turn up, these essentially emergent elites, and they create this fake, you know, sort of periphery group in Tunisian society that is supposedly, you know, at arms with the Tunisian regime. And they make appeals to this group of people that actually doesn't exist. And through that, they essentially turn the Tunisian government into a sort of secondary centre of power. It no longer becomes a central outlet of power in its own region because it's just been toppled. And now all these people who think they are free and they have revolted against the regime are just subjects of the American government.
Well, it brings us back to the point we were talking about when we talked about the Abigail Thorne stuff and the anti-COVID stuff. It's a great example of the fact that they, you know, the Juvenile model that Bond is extolling here has no room in it by design for these bottom-up actions by people who do not exist within the power structure. What you have is you have the power structure who reach down and elevate these elements, like the bread tube, like the activists in Tunisia, and they are used as justification for action. They are used as, you know, the smokescreen, the shield, and, you know, occasionally the sword of the elite class.
Yeah.
But the change is not instigated by these people. And, you know, the power wielded and the wealth put into it is done so from the outside via a top-down entity like the US government, like the UK government. And this has been extremely successful abroad, and now we're seeing it brought harder and harder and harder into domestic societies to not even like the soft propaganda degree it was in the past, in a very hard warfare footing here.
Mm.
Quite literally an info war, if you will.
Yes. But it's the fact that it gets all the more insidious. You know, instead of it being, you know, World War II and the American and British government are doing flyer campaigns over Germany and over Japan, and, you know, at least there is, as much as, you know, we've discussed those events at serious length, and it's all just essentially a mark on human history that should not be looked back upon because it's all horrendous. At least when the leaflet gets into your hands and you read it and you're the German dude, at least it says property of the US government. You know where it's coming from. Whereas all this stuff, you know, it is from these quote-unquote private channels. You know, it's these private media outlets, these public relations organizations, new social media upstart programs. You know, so much of what we think of as like what would be the phrase? Venture capital organizations. How many of these things are just fronts for the security state?
Well, Trigg, you'll have a better idea than we do, because I was, you know, when all this happened, I was 16.
Yes.
I wasn't following things as probably close as I could be, and I certainly wasn't comprehending them as well as I do now.
But I was looking at it going, holy shit, this shit glows like crazy. What the fuck is going off here? It's not grassroots. It was obvious at the time it wasn't grassroots.
Well, you remember how quickly it happened at the time. That's the thing I remember. And, you know, it was framed as this great awakening of democracy in the Middle East, that all these populations had finally woken up to how amazing Western democracy was, that they were throwing off the shackles of the old style, you know, dictatorship autocracy. Yeah. And that these groups would come forth and these new states would be born that would be free and would be liberal and they'd be just like us. And what happened pretty much immediately was that the traditional values of Islamism filled the void.
Yeah.
These societies defaulted to what they know, you know, on a most base level, which is Islam.
Hmm. Yeah. Every single time you ended up with a hard line, you know, the Muslim Brotherhood was usually the one that sort of was in the background filling the void.
Where does almost all militant radical Islamism come from? It comes from Wahhabi mosques in Saudi Arabia that are funded by the Israeli and the US government. Yes. And all the Deobandi stuff in Pakistan is, I've heard, is essentially just a front by GCHQ for putting Pakistani men we don't want in this country back in Pakistan to cause more uproar there.
It's been like that, really. Jihad as a concept, as a modern concept, is an invention of the US government to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan.
Mm. Well, yes. Yes, there is. But let's not sort of forget, there is a huge history going back, you know.
Oh, no. I know that there is traditional Islam, and then there is modern political Islam. And these two things are, in many ways, radically different. If you look at Islam as practiced in the 13th century, you know, the 14th century, and Islam as practiced post British Empire, there is a huge difference between how things shaped themselves in the 80s and the 90s than there is with the previous versions. Wahhabism is very different to many other forms of Islam to quite an extreme degree. Like a lot of the mega churches in America, what people would consider the extreme evangelicals, are very different than the traditional Anglicans or the Catholic Church. That is the degree of difference there is there.
Yes, but when the House of Saud took Saudi Arabia, they took it with Wahhabist extremists. It was basically like an ISIS ran through there. What I'm saying is that, yes, certainly the intelligence agencies are utilizing it. I'm also saying don't be thinking that it they were all nice and fluffy until...
Not at all. It's just Wahhabism is a product of Western forces trying to instigate an enemy both against the Soviets and themselves, because they aren't stupid.
It's utilized by it. It was there already. When they twinned the House of Saud, took Saudi Arabia, they raped and killed and murdered their way through.
If you go and read this book, Nemesis, you will find that Bond, I think, has the actual source on that very issue and talks about the creation of it in the 30s, 40s, I believe. Maybe I've got that wrong, but I think that is literally in this book somewhere, is the creation of Wahhabism as a movement by US government forces.
It would have likely been, if it was the US, it would have likely been the 50s. Although possibly, because I mean, there's the big oil rush, which again, another book everyone should read. And it's the TV
well, the thing
series
is,
as well. Is the price?
There's,
which is all about oil in the Middle East.
There's Wahhabism as practiced like pre 1970s, and there's Wahhabism as practiced post 1970s, and these things are very different.
Yeah, that's at least true. Yes,
there's a lot of the internationalist Islamist stuff is very recent in terms of, you know, looking westwards, looking to the, you know, the antagonism by the imperialist West. A lot of the pan-national Arab stuff was stuff like Ba'athism, which is much more in line with how movements were previously.
Even then, though, those people that instigated the Ba'ath Party were the tools of the British establishment
that bears a lot more resemblance to the more inward-looking Islam. A lot of people are like, oh, why don't the Muslims just go and fix their own nations? It's like, well, a lot of the time they're being pumped full of this propaganda that says that they shouldn't do that. And that they should, you know, they are essentially being agitated. And there is a lot of stuff going on, especially in the Middle East, you know, by these security forces that has helped invent this modern reinterpretation of Islam that really is you should go out and kill some Soviets.
Yeah, but you've also got sort of Sunni and Shia or Shiite or however you want to frame it or phrase it, that have been killing each other for years over who gets to lead the you know Islam and whether or not it should be family or
that's
imams.
Not an issue for the infidel though. That's no. You know, that's not our thing to be dealing with, and I think if you were to talk to a lot of Muslims people, they would agree with that. I mean, someone in the chat is talking about, you know, both of these branches of Islam were born out of a desire in Islamic communities to push back against Western or non-Islamic influences. That's completely untrue. I mean, that's part of the big lie about a lot of the stuff that happened in the 70s was that these countries weren't un-Islamized. It was just that there were some secular leaders who were essentially willing to allow religious populations to do as they please and allow secular populations to do as they please, and governments around the world decided, hey, wait, there's a slight split in people there, so we can amp that up, we can instigate and agitate it into something that's actually useful. I mean, to think that the Taliban grew out of a group of people in some caves who were, you know, like dirt farmers, is entirely untrue. It was born out of people who were, you know, Middle Eastern elites.
Yeah, there's a lot of people who ended up going into jihad who were Oxford educated.
You mean what was his name? Bin Laden, I think his name was. Yeah.
You end up with wealthy members of Saudi society, you know, like a construction mogul song, for instance. well, the one of the other things I want to talk about the very much the war on home coming to roost is some of the physical elements that you'll notice. We've got a whole bunch of pictures here, one of which is Iraq, in which they are taking down the concrete barriers. they are de-green zoning Baghdad, and yet if you look at UK city centres, UK town centres, I think almost all of them have these anti-vehicle barriers now.
Or some variant. It's either it's that or the big concrete blocks, or it's the silver barriers that come up and down. I mean, this is, if we go back to that previous one, Trig.
Yeah, sure. Oops, that, too far. There we go.
Oh, no, it's the one where you can see the big long street with the two yellow walkway gates on the left.
Got it. Yeah, yeah.
The one before, but yes. Sorry. But that is Princess Street in Edinburgh, and that is one of the most egregious examples I've seen. Because up and down the whole Royal Mile, for every junction, there are these big blockades and these barriers you walk through. And there is like something horrendous to even the colouring of them. And I think there is a later picture we've got here where it's the exact same barriers being painted up for the Fringe Festival.
Oh God, where is it?
We'll get that up in a sec. There's an article as well we want to read. But that's London Bridge, with the exact same concrete blocks we saw in Iraq. That's British Transport.
You gave me so many of these. There we go. They painted them for fucking rainbows on them, didn't they?
No. That's a different one. I think that's in there we go. That's the one where it looks like a jungle gym, and they've got like an entrance and an exit.
Yeah, this is the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is something just so. I mean, I think we were talking about it planning the stream yesterday. We both kind of came up with the same thing. It's like a jungle gym. They've tried to turn what is an abomination to both architecture and, to some extent, your sort of civil liberties. And they're just this colourful, playful thing. It's like something out of like part of the background of a Barney TV show or something. It's horrible. Well,
there's the issue that we have not seen the end point of what these were installed for. These were very obviously not just installed because of the threat from Islamism.
No.
Because the UK government functionally does not care if you get blown up by a brown person. Otherwise they wouldn't have imported hundreds of thousands of them every year into the UK.
The same thing we said again, or a similar thing we're discussing yesterday. Why didn't all this stuff arrive during when the IRA was bombing the UK?
Yes, we had literal truck bombs driven into the heart of Manchester that required the entire city centre to be remodelled. And things like this never appeared in the 90s. We never had British Transport Police walking around in every train station in the UK with visible automatic weapons.
Hmm.
That didn't happen.
I mean, those are everywhere now. I mean, I was stopped by, someone that looked very much like these guys. Years ago, I was driving to see my sister, and all of a sudden, I'm pulled over to one side because they were looking for someone that happened to be driving a very similar model of car to me. I was driving an Audi A3 at the time. They'd actually got the Audi A3 they were looking for because they were busy dragging four or five black lads out of a car that was clearly being hotboxed. There was smoke blowing out the windows of it, and, it wasn't on fire. Maybe a couple of small fires going off in there. They clearly caught the guys that they wanted to, but nonetheless, they pulled me over as well, and guy stood at the window, and right behind him, there's a guy with a rifle pointed straight at my head. And I don't know about you, but when someone points a rifle at my head, certainly with the, my background, I don't like it. I get very, very upset when someone points a rifle at my head. It's clear intent.
That's quite bad doctrine, because even American police don't come out weapons drawn.
Should have been at the low ready. He should have been at low ready. He wasn't. I was looking straight down the barrel, and I commented to him. I said to the guy, I said, "What the hell are you doing pointing a rifle at me?" He's like, "Oh, well, you should feel safe with us out here, guarding the streets." I'm like, "Fuck off. No one's pointed a rifle at me in years, apart from you."
I'm looking at this image for a second. I'm seeing that woman on the right. What is she, 5'2", 5'4"? She's wearing tactical gloves that are too big for her hands. I'm sure she's going to have fantastic trigger control with those. The dude on the left's got his finger on the trigger. Near enough. What's...
Yeah, it's in the trigger well. No, he's got no trigger discipline. The guy should not be holding that rifle.
Yeah, but welcome to Britain 2021, where there are two armed British Transport Police in the corner of every prêt-à-manger across the country.
Now that's the big thing. There's the image of London Bridge. London Bridge, if you've ever been there, has a horrendous density of these barriers. The entire footway is obstructed by them. There's concrete barriers between the road and the footway.
Mm-hmm.
There's another image which is more recent, which is a bit more zoomed out. These were the temporary ones, but the permanent ones are actually even more egregious. I've walked past them a few times recently because when I've been around London. There we go. That's the one. This is what London Bridge looks like now. And it's going to look like that, for the foreseeable future. This is just what British city centres look like, and we've learned to accept this. But it's a constant physical reminder that these are essentially green zones, that there is a huge amount of preparation going on, because they expect at some point to be fighting people in large vehicles, which doesn't bode very well. Because these things aren't...
Obviously, someone in the chat's pointed out something that I noticed a while ago. After living in central London, I'm convinced there are two classes of police internally. You see the tall, serious ones in pairs, and then you get the midget diversity hires in pairs. I can tell you for a fact, when I was living in Stirling, between 10 o'clock in the morning and 6 p.m. at night, it's diddy police. It's fat birds walking about. As soon as the shift change happens, it's all big, burly ex-squaddies. And, you know, it goes from, the Vauxhall Astra's cutting about with two of them to a van full of six of them. You know, it's very blatant that the security state is being so heavily managed. You know, it's not just that, like, the local police are deciding to do a different rotation of shifts because they think that works. No, they are being told, as were ambulance drivers that were told to basically drive around blaring the blues and twos, wearing hazmat suits and an ambulance by themselves, to basically go out and create a public image of being enforced.
Yes. There's also the problem that a lot of people have been sold the idea of visible policing. They have been sold the lie that having, boots on the ground and, beat cops on the street is what creates security. And when it functionally isn't, it's what creates the appearance of security.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'll start quoting The Wire, but most major cases are built on large scale investigations. They're built on actual functional things like legal warrants. They're not built on people going around getting hassled in the street or randomly pulling people's cars over and aiming firearms at them. Deliberate enforcement, where you want actual crime to be solved. That's not how it works.
the interesting kind of thing is we normally associate this kind of stuff with, National Socialism in Germany and the Stasi and, even maybe later examples of, and someone in chat mentioned China. And I think, part of the main reason for so many of these measures has nothing to do with ideology or even necessarily the concept of defending the nation. They are a prerequisite for the managerial techniques required to keep a society such as ours going. I mean, it's so close to the point of bursting, much like all these Middle Eastern states that spent years and years subverting via social media and media, that you then need all these people on the street with guns.
Yeah, it's this, a lot of it is post-hoc, like we always talk about. A lot of the ideology stuff is just, it's just there to create a narrative around what is happening. Mm. What is actually happening is that these people have sensed a loss of control over time. Mm. And that they feel that they need greater control to keep this amount of people all moving in the same direction that benefits them. It is that simple.
But yeah, even the picture in front of us, it's framed as, this is the sort of measures we have to put in after the one lone man drove a van down London Bridge and killed however many people, blah, blah, blah. But what you end up with is something like Westminster basically being an isolated fortress on one side of the river that you can't get to with vehicles because the road's blocked off.
Yep. It's, like I said, it's green zone. It's an Iraq-style green zone. Washington is like that, and a lot of UK towns and cities have become like that, most notably London. If you walk around Parliament now, because I've done it a few times over the past few months, you will see that there are... And actually, you probably get in trouble for counting them, but I actually counted them. Mm. There are 15 around the perimeter of Parliament when I was there. Go vans, all with the riot mesh on them. And I presume all of them have rotating shifts of people, because you see people coming in and out of them. And all of these exist. They exist in these like rolling barriers, this rolling protective network. And there are probably, at any moment, 200 to 250 police officers, most of them probably armed, within and without Parliament.
Well, those aren't just police officers. Those are City of London police, who are effectively military officers working under like a set of orders that were written in like the 1500s to protect the city of London as like its own, you know, sovereign entity. That, you know, they are like hired mercenaries that you would have got, you know, when you were attacking and sieging towns in the 16th century. It's
also, bear in mind, I don't know if you know this, there's certainly every single train station in London and a large number of the major tube stations have basically a police armory in there, where a cop is able to go in there and grab body armor, assault rifle, you name it, you know, fully automatic and select fire rifles of 5.56 or 7.62 caliber. There in these places, in every single train station, every single tube station that is a major one at least. Even if they're not armed, they can be within a few minutes. There are huge numbers of armories all over London.
Well, I was going to say, was it not when you were doing some work that was related to the London Underground, when you were looking at certain bits of it, there were tunnels where you were basically told, like, no, you don't go down there, or there are exits that you don't go out, because... John, because when he was doing some of the stuff when you were working for the big clothes manufacturer and whatever else, it was like, you know, don't take pictures of these side streets because they've basically got like G4S black sites on them.
I've done numerous construction surveys in London, and the actual physical security is extremely woeful, apart from in very small areas. In which, if you are taking pictures externally of a building that might contain pictures of other buildings behind it, the function of which is unknown, you will get someone in extremely familiar garb. They're dressed. If I say they're dressed like a milkman, you'll know what I mean, but no one else will. You'll get someone who's stocky, who has a slight received pronunciation accent. And who stands in a way in which he will not be pushed over with his hands interlocked behind his back. And he will ask you very politely what you are doing there. And I've had this experience at least 5 separate occasions. Generally you just explain what you're doing and say, okay, as long as you're not taking pictures of X building, you're fine. And there are all kinds of areas in London in which if you take a picture of a street or a building, you will be very quickly bungled into that building if you do not say the right thing. I know this for a fact, because it's nearly happened to a couple of people that I know. This exists completely without what we would consider public oversight. No one really knows this is going on. But it's something I've been told about by people who are adjacent to it, but it's also just something that you experience if you spend an extended amount of time in the capital. There are usually streets in London that have two unmarked police cars at the bottom of them, and they're usually very empty, and they usually contain the very large townhouse in them. And a lot of those areas will be where the security state operates. There'll be essentially a GCHQ station. There's probably a GCHQ station in London every few streets. And this has all arisen since the Blair years. This did not exist. All of this, the anti-terror barriers, the armed police on public transport, none of this existed in its 20 to 25 years ago. This has been a substantial change in British society, a very visible change in British society over the last 25 years. And it has been done because it has been experimented with in the Middle East and then brought home again.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've, you know, as the Grey Zone article said at the start of it, once these organisations have perfected their methods in the Middle East, they apply them in the West in even more sort of pervasive and twisted sort of ways.
That's why I think there's a huge amount of naivety with people who talk about the process and elections and, you know, essentially very twee political action. They do not understand the realities that they're, if they live in a major city centre, they probably walk past people who are, you know, direct or indirect employees of the security state every single day. And that there are infrastructures of control that they would consider conspiratorial that are openly talked about.
Well, obviously, speaking of things that are conspiratorial, should we get into, for the last little bit here, something possibly even more sort of, I think insidious is probably the correct word when it comes to the instigation of biometric technology that seems to be, for the most part, prototyped again in the Middle East to track and trace and basically monitor the Taliban, are now being used pretty much at whim on the British public and the American public.
Yes. If you want to, do you want to read the Intercept article first?
I think we could probably just go into the Rand Corporation stuff, because I think that's where the real meat and bones of it is.
Okay, there's just for a bit of context here, there was a huge effort in Afghanistan and Iraq to document these supposed jihadis, many of which were suspected of being jihadis because they had things like digital watches, or they had been turned in by somebody from a neighboring village because bounties had been offered. It was a very large dragnet of people in Iraq and Afghanistan, and to a lesser extent Pakistan, that were turned over to the American forces and documented in excruciating detail. And one of the main ways that they were pushing to do this was biometrics.
Mm-hmm.
Iris scanning, fingerprints, voice printing, you know, face recognition, things that are being brought slowly into the, you know, the security of our devices. I had my phone, you know, my bank has been insisting through their app that I need to register my face with them, and I won't do that. And they've actually limited the transactions I can make, because apparently the card reader I've got isn't good enough anymore. And I've complained about that, and I've got some of my service back, but they very much were pushing me and trying to punish me for not using facial recognition technology through their app.
I used to know a guy who was working for the United States Armed Forces as a contractor, and his job, the reason I knew him is he was taking some time off for basically psychological damage, because it was his job to go through gun camera footage, which is actually remarkably detailed these days, and bomb camera footage, and do biometrics on people as the bombs were dropping. You know, literally as the cruise missile went through the window, they would stop a freeze frame and literally screen cap everybody on there and try to work out who they were, what areas of what country they came from via biometrics on the firearms and ordnance that they were delivering, you know, half a second before these people were blown into tiny fragments.
No, there is a PDF that is then linked on that website.
I would just get the direct one up, the one that's linked in our chat, rather than the one on the website opens really weirdly. So if you can get the PDF to open in your browser, sorry, just some behind the scenes stuff. Trig, it's the one below the Guardian link.
Discuss this idea of identity dominance.
Yes,
which is just it's really getting into the meat and potatoes of the newspeak.
Yes, the thing is, this PDF was produced in 2005, very much I think at the high watermark of the war on terror. This is after Bush's re-election. This is after the invasion of Iraq, and this is really kind of 2 years into the fervor of the enforcement in the Middle East. This is the height of enhanced interrogation, for instance. There is really nothing off the table at this point, and so this Rand Corporation document is as out and front as it can be with a lot of this, talking about centralized databases, detainee processing, you know, fingerprints, face, DNA, all of this stuff. Identity dominance.
They are using, you know, these different facets of iris scans, of face scans, of voice, of DNA, of fingerprint, so that they can place people even in a country as sort of technologically developed as Afghanistan, pretty much 24/7. You know, imagine, you know, if they've got all that stuff and the location data for your phone, they know what you're up to every minute. They probably know, you know, when, what you're thinking at every moment and when you're next going for a shit.
Oh, Facebook can predict it. I'm sure the intelligence services can.
Hmm. Well, just say, how do you think the intelligence services got their data?
Yeah. Well, but it's part of it.
This is then the stuff, though, that directly connected to the Zinc organization that was mentioned in the Grey Zone article, that, you know, I don't think, well, we'd maybe need to do a tiny bit more digging, but I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that the very people that worked on this stuff in the early 2000s, people, funnily enough, that were part of Blair's government and were probably direct advisors to Blair, who now work at the Tony Blair Institute, where they're developing health passes and vaccine IDs and cryptography, you know, secured biometric data. And it's once you start peeling away at all these different layers and you actually see who's involved, it's all the same people doing the same stuff. They just did it over there, they perfected it, and then they brought it back here. And now they're, you know, over a slightly longer process and over a slightly more convoluted and existential issue called COVID, they're enforcing it.
The meat and potatoes of this at the end, they talk about all kinds of, you know, biometric technological support, identity dominance, you know, have they previously been arrested? Have they used aliases? Have they been detained by the forces? Have they been linked to terrorist activity? But the very last paragraph in this document is amazing because of the language it uses. Throughout the document, they refer to red forces, which is a generic name for any force the American government defines as an enemy. There is no defined foe that this is being used against. It is open-ended. But at the end of the document, there's a little patch here where it says, the future. and I will just read this bit. It's just before the notes there, Drake. It says, in the global war on terror, the relevance of biometric technology has grown exponentially. The military must achieve identity dominance, where military forces have the distinct ability to separate friend from foe by linking people to their previous identities and past terrorist or criminal activities. We can use biometric technology to achieve identity dominance and must deploy it to meet the requirements of force protection, actionable intelligence and law enforcement, establishing identity dominance through a comprehensive ABIS, basically a database, will enable the US military to identify friend or foe to keep America safer.
Well, I mean, the mask off bit to me there, I mean, not to go on a complete ramble, but after reading Filmer's Patriarch, or currently reading it, I'm looking at law in a different way than I was before. But, you know, law enforcement, when they say it there, is not that they can go into Afghanistan and make it a civil society. They can go into Afghanistan and force their law so that they are effectively the law. And that, you know, it is an open admittance that they are using this technology in these states to suppress movements that would otherwise execute sovereignty in parts of the Middle East.
There's also the way law enforcement is used in American doctrine is generally domestic.
Mm.
They're really talking about a domestic use of this. And there's a very tantalizing hint of bringing this home because they are talking about, you know, friend and foe. There is, like I said, there is no scope here. It is whoever America says it is. And, you know, you can't run from that. If they identify you as an enemy through biometrics, you will always be an enemy. You can't slot yourself back into society. You know, there is no, it's essentially like the total war version of the war on terror. In that if you are at any point in your life identified as an enemy of the American Empire, that they will hunt you to the ends of the earth for having the temerity to be identified by them as an enemy. And as I mentioned before, and as I put out on Twitter, one of the requirements that they used for shipping people off to Guantanamo Bay was wearing, at the time, I think still is, the most popular watch in the world, which is just the very basic Casio F91W. which they've been selling since the 80s, and they got around that by classifying the most popular digital watch on the planet as bomb making equipment. And yeah, it's all fun and games, and I've talked about this before, but there have been and there will be warrants that use things like security forces finding something like the Joe Rogan podcast on your phone as, you know, signs of radicalization. It is not ridiculous to say that, because they have literally used the most popular watch in the world as bomb making equipment.
Well, that's why I got slightly miffed Fair Cop and Toby Young and all these people celebrating. They're like, oh, the government's no longer going to register non-hate crime incidents. That doesn't mean that the records that are already there are going to disappear anytime soon.
If anything, they'll just reclassify them.
Exactly.
They'll use a different euphemism for them. I'm not sure if we have time to talk about it, but there's... You could probably actually fold it into a different stream, the White Helmet stuff. I found a lot more on it, and I'd actually like to do that at a later date, because it's such a smoking gun on this topic.
Yeah, I fell out with a big chunk of my family, because they were... Years ago, when they were during Syria... And they're the peak of them. Because they were like, oh, White Helmets, at least there's some people out there doing some good. I was like, are you kidding me? These are the absolute worst. They're a propaganda state for the Islamists, etc.
I would say it's worse. They're not even propagandists for, like, Islamists. They're propagandists for globalists.
Same diff.
Yes.
I don't even think I'd slander genuine Islamists with that kind of shit.
If we do another deep dive into the war on terror, and I would like to use Scott Horton's enough already, because there is some good stuff in there that I did know before and I didn't know before. I would love to talk about the White Helmets in detail, because I was going to tack it onto the end of the stream, but quite honestly, with the other stuff that I found, there is an whole like arc to go through here.
I think there's a lot more we can grab from Nemesis as well on the subject.
Yes, because the Nemesis and the Juvenilian model of power is a great illustration of this stuff. It's a great kind of... A lot of people get very confused by the global war on terror and all that, and where the power dynamics lie and why they're doing certain things and who the real actors are. And I think it's a great way of demystifying it, is to use Nemesis, because it really cuts through the bullshit. Again, it's what I've been doing all along here, which is power analysis. It's like, who benefits? It's a very basic look at who benefits and why certain actions are undertaken. And it's, once you look at it that way, you really just demystify many of the...
It begins to make no sense whatsoever, and it becomes the only logical explanation, given the fact that we know people only ever, especially elites and individuals in elite positions, they engage in action that is purposeful towards some kind of end. And it would be an interesting question to maybe leave the stream on to tie up with other stuff, that, you know, if they are lifting social influencers up so that they can put forward the message about COVID, if they are, you know, putting anti-terror barriers that inconvenience your life on pretty much, you know, every major street corner, and there are armed police in pretty much every major train station. What does that serve? You know, what sort of society are they looking to manufacture out of these methods, essentially?
Just before I go, I got another $2 from Mr. Omeo Kane, I think it is. He's talking about Lex Fridman again. He says his PhD thesis was literally on this technology. I'll have to have a look into that.
I did actually put the name of the PhD thesis in the chat earlier on. I copied it, but I haven't. I've lost it now.
Cool. Anyway, thank you for tuning in, guys. We've had a pretty decent and consistent amount of viewers, which is good, because we took such a long-ass break. So thank you for sticking with us while we had a bit of a holiday over Christmas, because we've all been rather busy. Yeah. To be fair, I don't really live in a major city. Neither do you, Evelyn. I don't think you really do, Trigger. We're all either suburban or peripheral.
Yeah, I well, I mean, yeah, Midlands is there's a few cities around here, but I mean, Birmingham's the biggest, but I wouldn't call it a major city. Major blight on the landscape more than anything else. But yeah, so.
Yes, well,
I'm a country boy. I've grown up in the countryside. I think
I was
going to
say quickly before we end, I will mention I am planning to do a stream on Monday using a bit more Sam Francis to go over. I haven't managed to work out who is planning to join me for that or not. I don't know if I'm brave enough to do a solo stream yet.
I might. If it's Monday, I could probably join you. If no one else can.
I can't on Mondays, I'd leave it.
It'd be good to have a quick go over because I know you're going to be doing Beautiful Losers, and I've not read over the physical version we've got yet because I'm very happy we've got that, but the digital version was great. I really enjoyed that book. So
yeah, I've not read through it completely, but I think you've seen the two chapters that I picked out to go over, and they fit together rather well. Someone's asking when the Nomos tickets will be up. I would hope that we can sell tickets for the next event before January is over.
I've got some stuff lined up. We'll go over it probably over the weekend.
Yeah, I suppose we can discuss it next weekend, yeah?
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
Cool.
Okay, well thank you guys for tuning in.
Thank you everyone that supports the channel and whatever else so that we can totally buy books and not beer.
I bought so many books. Look out for, I know quite a few people have recently subscribed to the Substack, antipolitics.substack.com. There's been a bit of a lack of content in there for a bit, but there are quite a few articles in the work from me. I just need to get my time together to do them. I also busted up my hand recently, so I'm struggling to type a little bit. But don't worry, I'm not permanently disabled. But unless there's anything else you guys want to shill, I will say good evening from us, I guess.
Indeed. And Happy New Year, everyone. I hope you've all had a good little holiday.
Happy 2022.
I hope we're all ready for 2020 part two.
2020. Right, I've...